We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you by Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Okay, we have to start on time because Rabbi Berman has a plane ticket so he can hear the Megillah on Yud Dalet Adar. He lives in Beit Shemesh, you know, just outside the border, I think, of Yud Dalet Tetvav territory. Anyway, it's a pleasure to have Rabbi Dr. Berman, he's been for the last number of years, is a professor in the Department of Tanakh, a Bible at Bar-Ilan University. He taught at Nishmat and many, many of the yeshivot and seminaries in Israel for a long time. There may be people who remember he ran a number of years ago the Yarchei Kala that, you know, Chana Henkin does here every year. One year he ran it for her, twice he ran it for her. And his new book that has just come out for sale here, Created Equal, How the Bible Broke with Ancient Political Thought, which was the finalist in the National Jewish, you know, Book Award. So it just came out, so I just saw it. But it's a very interesting approach. I guess I'm positive. I haven't really read it except for the back cover. Jonathan Sachs has a comment here on the back cover I mentioned yesterday. James, you know, Kugel has a comment. And really, it's a pleasure to have him to teach. You'll hear he's a wonderful teacher. He lives in Beit Shemesh with his wife and four children. And thank you very much for joining us over the weekend.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I every time that I get up to speak, I feel that I have an enormous weight on my shoulders because I have to present the Dvar Hashem, and I have to do it faithfully, and I have to do it in a way that will be well-received, and that's always a heavy burden. But then when I have a title like this morning, Economic Downturns, Biblical Remedies, then I sort of feel like I have the weight of the entire world economy on my shoulders, and that I really have to deliver the goods this morning. And that's why you folks would get up at the ungodly hour that you did this morning, having lost an hour of sleep. Maybe there'll be some great solution here that they haven't figured out in Ottawa or Washington or anywhere else. So I'll start with one insight about the world economy. You know, we read yesterday, Timche et Zecher Amalek mitachat hashamayin. Amalek we have to totally obliterate and wipe out. And it turns out that the gematria of Amalek is dollar. So I'll let you savor that. Well, it's certainly happening. You know, I don't know whether the Torah was mechaven for the U.S. dollar or the Canadian dollar or the Australian dollar or all the dollars combined, apparently. Okay. What we're going to be looking at this morning is very familiar things in a very unfamiliar way. When we think about what the Torah has to say about economics, I sense that we probably all have a sense of it in a very piecemeal fashion. Well, there's a couple of psukim here and there about staka, a couple of psukim here and there about Eved Ivri, a pasuk or two about Yovel, and it's all sort of diffuse, and there doesn't really seem to be a coherent economic theory about how economy should be set up. But there really is one, and that's what I want to share with you here this morning. What I'm going to be doing this morning is based, as Jay held up before, my new book, Created Equal, How the Bible Broke with Ancient Political Thought. Let me explain a little bit about the general context of this book and then how it's going to relate to what we're going to be doing here this morning. In the ancient world, the truth was self-evident. All men are not created equal. Everywhere else, in Egypt, north of Israel, in Mesopotamia, where Avram Avinu came from, all of those societies were very hierarchical, very stratified. You had kings, and you had nobles, and down beneath you had serfs and servants, and everybody knew their place. And nobody could move from one realm to the other. If you had all the haves at the top and all the have-nots at the bottom, and everyone thought this is exactly the way the world is supposed to be. And what I'm trying to claim in this new book that I put out is that the Torah is the first blueprint for a culture that will be far more egalitarian. Not so much in the sense of men and women, but in the sense of haves and have-nots, who holds the power, who does not, and a broad attempt to empower and ennoble the common person. And that this comes through in many ways. It comes through in which the ways in which we view HaKadosh Baruch Hu as opposed to the ways in which other peoples conceived their gods, Lahavdil, comes out in terms of political office, but it also comes out, and this is what we're going to be focusing on this morning, in terms of how the Torah views economics. I want to begin, as we begin to discuss the Torah's economic plan, how it was so radically different back then, and also, no less significant, what it has to say to us today, with an insight from a man that I consider practically a Navi in our times. And when I say a Navi, I don't mean someone who peers into a crystal ball and tells us the future, but because that's not really what most of the Navim did in the Tanakh. A Navi is someone who comes and tells it like it is, that everyone is under some sort of delusion or missing some main point about what's going on in society at large, and the Navi comes and says, no, you guys got it all wrong. This is really what's happening. The Navi that I have in mind is named Robert Putnam. Not such a Jewish name, I know. He's not really Jewish either. That's okay. He can still be a Navi. Bilam was a Navi. Robert Putnam is a sociologist at Harvard. And he wrote a very, very influential book about 10 years ago called Bowling Alone. And, bowling. You know, big heavy ball, pins, gutters. Bowling Alone. And this was the thesis of his book. He charted the way in which in America, and I suspect to a large degree, it probably is true of Canada as well, that in America in the last half of the 20th century, all participation and membership in communal types of organizations went down. Union membership across the board in this period went down. Church membership down. Synagogue membership down. Blood drives down. PTA meetings down. Card games down. Elks, Lions clubs down. You name it. Anything that once was participatory, voluntary, all these things were down. His signature statistic was that at the end of the 20th century, Americans were actually bowling more than they ever had been before, but in a different way. That in earlier times, Americans had formed bowling teams and bowling leagues, and now they were bowling alone. You know, you just go to the lanes, rent a ball, don't look around at anybody, and bowl your game. This we know in terms of the Jewish community. There's been a great lament that in the Jewish community, participation in UJA or whatever its parallels are here, or anything having to do with Jewish communal life, has been on the wane. True in America and probably true here in Canada as well. It's part of a larger, broader cultural phenomenon. And what Putnam points out is that all of this comes at a very great cost, because when people have a proclivity to join a shul, join a PTA meeting, join some type of voluntary association in a hospital, this brings out and it fosters within people very good qualities. People that join tend to trust more, they tend to be less cynical, they tend to be more caring about other people's suffering, they tend to be less egotistical. And that all of this, when people begin to withdraw from organizations, you get the opposite. Now, all of this is bad enough by itself, but now, in 2009, we're in a situation, not just here in this room, obviously, but culture-wise, maybe even world-wise, where we're no longer just bowling alone. Now, we're owing alone. Owing alone, right? Everyone's in stuch. And that's a bad place to be. Owing is a bad place to be. Owing alone is a really bad place to be. It turns out that people who are joiners, people who join clubs, people who join PTA meetings, people who join churches and synagogues, tend, on a whole, statistically, to fare better during bad times. They fare better emotionally. They fare better in terms of contacts they have with other people to help find jobs and new sources of income. They even fare better physically. It's been all documented in many studies. And so the situation we're in is where a lot of people are in bad financial shape. and this sort of myth of the Western world of the self-made man. Self-made man is terrific when you're on the way up, because then you take all the credit for having made a fortune, for having been a very successful doctor, lawyer, businessman, whatever it is. To be a self-made man is great on the way up. On the way down, it's bad news, because now all you have to lean on is yourself, and you're out of work because your firm shut down, your bank shut down. And it's in this situation that suddenly all those big ties of community can really kick in a big way, in terms of contacts, in terms of emotional support, which then turns into a better physical posture during difficult times. And what I want to try to demonstrate this morning is that the Torah's economic policy and grand theory, and there is a grand theory here, is aimed towards precisely bad times. And it's aimed precisely towards strengthening communal bonds as a bulwark against bad times. Because strong communities are the best hedge for all when the hedge funds fall. And that's what we're going to see here this morning in the material that we're going to be looking at. Okay, let's have a look on the handout. This is from Vayikra Chafei, which, as many of you will recognize, is the perek in Chumash that discusses the dinim of Yovel. And we're going to be looking at some of these dinim and see what's on the surface, and then I think significantly from a theoretical perspective, what's under the surface, how different what's said here was different from what was going on elsewhere in the ancient world, and what it has to tell us today as well. Okay, so let's have a look. We have here on the first page, I'd like us to look in Pasuk Yud. The Pasuk Yud says here that in the Yovel year, V'kidashtem et shnat ha-chamishim shana, ukratem dror ba'aretz l'chol yoshveha. Right, so we have to make the Yovel year, we have to declare it, and there'll be some type of freedom, dror ba'aretz l'chol yoshveha. Yovel hi tiye lachem, it'll be the Yovel year, v'shavtem ish el achuzato, v'ish el mishpachto tashuvu. Everyone will return to their ancestral holding of land, and everyone will return to their family. Two phrases. They will return to their land, and they will return to their family. I want to explain what's going on here. As, of course, we all know, Eretz Yisrael was split into nachalot. Each shevet, right, got its ancestral holding, and then that was divvied up. And then each subunit, clans and families, received a piece of nachalot. I want to explain about why this is really such a revolutionary idea. You know, in the ancient world, there really was no idea of private property. Property belonged to a mix of sort of the king and the temples. This is the way it was everywhere. People worked on the land, but kind of in a rental type of fashion. People didn't really own land. The first culture in which we discovered that people owned private property is in the Torah. And we know that in the ancient world where people worked in an agricultural setting, to own a piece of land was economic security. And this is what the Torah really tried to do. You know, we know the Torah doesn't really say how much land the king gets. It doesn't say anything about giving land to the king. It doesn't say anything about giving land to the Mikdash or to the Kohanim. In fact, the Kohanim don't get any land at all, just a little place to live. All of Eretz Yisrael is given out to the people so that every person, every family has some economic security. And the aim here in the Yovel year is that no matter what's happened in the meantime, economically, you get back to base one and have a steady source of income by receiving or going back to that piece of land that was allotted to you. Maybe in contemporary terms, it just highlights the importance that I think is implicitly understood by policymakers here and in Washington, the importance of jobs, that's bedrock. We have to try to find ways for people to have secure sources of income. The other reason that having private property, or in modern terms, since we don't really work in agriculture anymore, not even in Israel, of having jobs, it's not just so that people will have something to make some money off of, but there's an important aspect in terms of social cohesion as well. When people are really down and out, and despair, and have no prospect for the future, then they begin to withdraw from society. This is what lays the seeds for anarchy. The flip side of the coin is true as well. When people feel a basic economic security, they might not be raking it in, but they know where their next meal is coming from, and they feel confident about their economic security, then they're ready to contribute their part to society. They're ready to be productive members of society. They believe in society. So beyond the good that having a steady source of income does for each individual, it does wonders for society. And so the Torah wanted to make sure that Am Yisrael would be a steady society, and so therefore the importance of granting everybody a little piece of land. But the pasuk doesn't just say v'shaftem ish el achuzato. Each person will go back to their allotted land. V'ish el mishpachto tashuvu. And that, I think, is even more important. What does this mean, v'ish el mishpachto tashuvu? It's not like, you know, coming home for the holidays or for Pesach or something like that. Ish el mishpachto tashuvu. We know that the ways in which the land of Israel was apportioned back then, it was by tribe, and then it was by clan, and then it was by subclan, and then it was by individual family. But what this meant is that you always lived right near your brothers and your sisters and your cousins and your second cousins. And this is the way it was meant to be. Now, I don't know, some people find that a little bit stifling. You know, there's all these jokes about, ugh, the Seder, I have to see Aunt Tilly again. Oh, God. Like, you know, sometimes getting together with cousins and relatives can be wonderful, and then sometimes it's not so wonderful. This is why I say, by the way, that I like Chutz La'aretz much better. Two Sedarim. You see, in Israel, there's only one Seder, and so you have to have everybody at the table, whether you really like them or not. Here, you can get away with both. The first Seder, I have those cousins, which I have to have, but, you know, can't really deal with them. And the second Seder, okay, we'll have just us, you know, we'll do our thing. But in the long term, what the Torah has in mind, or had in mind, is that we should all live together with next of kin, brothers, sisters, cousins, extended cousins. Now, why is this? Why is this? This, I think, has an economic purpose behind it, because it means that we are invested in each other over the long term. It means that I know that if I go down, if something happens to me, it could be a work accident, it could be disease, I know that I have a social network of people around me who are going to help me. You know, you see this today, or we see this in Israel. Palestinian society is very much based on this principle. There's almost no individual identity, but everyone is very much tied in. And I'm always amazed when I take my car, for example, for repair, and there's an Arab guy from East Jerusalem who's my mechanic, and I speak to him sometimes. He's a nice, from Muslim, not too radical, and he tells me that he takes half of his salary and he gives it to his father. It's amazing. And that, you know, he has a brother who's in trouble and he gives him part of the money too. This is just part of the culture of living together in a clan, or what we call in Hebrew, a chamula. It pays enormous economic dividends because it means that no matter what happens to you individually, there's a whole safety network that's there. This, of course, can only exist if you have people living together. So the Torah has this in mind. Yeah, you can go off, you can go live somewhere, but this is where your land is. This is where you are meant to be. And because we're all together and, relatively speaking, immobile in terms of capacity to buy and live somewhere else permanently, we're all there for each other. What it means is that when things do begin to go wrong and others help us, I would almost dare say that it's no longer really considered chesed. I want us to think about chesed generally, acts of chesed that we're familiar with, and chesed in our own community, and you'll see that there's a little bit of a difference. If I go off to a hospital on the other side of the city and I do Bikur Cholim, that's chesed. I don't know that person, might even be Jewish. They might not ever see me again. That's chesed. But now think about what happens within our community. It happens in my community in Beit Shemesh. I'm sure it happens here as well. Someone is sitting Shiva. Suddenly, the doorbells keep ringing, and there's food coming in all the time. Trays of food. The neighbors have mobilized. Those trays of food that comes in. That happens to everybody here, right? That's what goes on. Or if, Rahman al-Itzlan, someone is ill. Same thing. You don't ask. You don't pick up the phone. The doorbell keeps ringing, and the food keeps pouring in. Now, that's a nice thing to do. But think about what's really happening here. It's a very different type of chesed. What's really happening here is what anthropologists would call a type of primitive insurance. Okay? Because I know that if my neighbor is sitting Shiva today and I bring him chicken soup, then I know that tomorrow when the tables are turned, I'll get chicken soup back too. It's not that I'm really making that calculation, I really don't want to do this, but I want to be able to get it when I'm sitting. No, it just happens in a kind of reflexive way. And the strong communal bonds that we have in places like this allow for a kind of modern version of this. We're all living together over a very long time, and because of it, when times are bad, we have a little bit to fall back on that comes out explicitly when people are ill or when people are sitting Shiva. In a certain way, Shabbos is a brilliant idea. Beyond what it tells us about a Kodesh Baruch Hu, it forces us to live together, and it forces us to see each other at least once a week in shul. That has economic advantage for all of us in the type of primitive insurance that I mentioned before. One second. And I think, I mean, I know it's this way at home for me, and I suspect that here as well. I can think of individuals in our community where I live in Beit Shemesh that have undergone disaster, just absolute disaster, physically in terms of health issues. And the community has, you know, rallied around, and those people get a monthly check from the tzedakah fund in the shul because everybody has put in a little bit. Is that chesed? It's a type of chesed, but it's much more a sense of we are all in this together. And when the other guy is down, everyone kicks in for him. And then one day if I'm down, then I can have a certain sense of assurance without anything written anywhere, but just out of a sense of community that others are going to do for me as well. And this is very much lacking in an age when we're not just bowling alone, but owing alone. Because I suspect that even here today, if people are in a very distressed state financially, there are ways in which our institutions function where somehow relief is able to be provided. This is what the Torah had in mind when it gave Am Yisrael not just pieces of land, but insisted that they live together, that there be strong communities that endure throughout the ages. Communities that, of course, are based on kinship, brothers, cousins, extended cousins. And we can see this, in fact, in some of the other dinim here on the handout that I've given you. Let's see how this sense of ish el mishpachto, everyone will return to his group unit, his family, and how that can help in bad times, is meant to play itself out. Look in Pasuk Chaf Hei. Pasuk Chaf Hei. Yeah. Chaf Hei. It's on the second page. Yeah. Ve'chi kiyamuch achicha u'machar me'achuzato uva goalo akarov elav v'ga'al et mimkar achiv. If a person finds himself in bad financial straits and he's forced to sell his property, right, the Torah gave him, then the Torah says here, uva goalo akarov elav goel, literally savior, but it really is a whole pecking list of family members. Probably the first in line are brothers, second in line cousins, third in line second cousins, etc., etc. Those people are called the goel. Ba goalo akarov elav v'ga'al et mimkar achiv. Then cousins are expected to come along and purchase the land back for that relative. This is not called chesed. This is a chiyuv. This is part of being, of existing economically, not just on my own, self-made man, but as part of a larger group. We can see a similar sort of thing in Pasuk Mem Zayin on the same page. V'chi tasig yad ger v'toshav imach, umach achicha imo v'nimkar leger toshav imach, o le'eker mishpacha ger. Let's say that the situation has gotten even worse. Could be because of disease or famine, and the relative of yours has not only now sold his property, but he's now had to sell himself into a type of debt servitude to someone who is like a foreigner living amongst Am Yisrael. Memchet acharei nimkar geulat yelo echad me'echav yigalenu. The same sort of thing. It is expected now that the family members will come along and bail him out, so that he will be able to return to the standing of being a free man and on his property. So this is the first thing. It really runs through all of these dinim here in Yovel, how economically we're really meant to function not as individuals, we're meant to function as a group, as a community, back then, as a clan. There are other revolutions that the Torah had economically. In the ancient world, I guess there always have been, taxes. Ooh. I don't know, do you guys say here, when they read the Megillah, and they say, Vayasem Achashverosh, Mas al Haaretz, V'yeh Hayam, that he, it's the very last, it's like the second to last pasuk in the Megillah, that Achashverosh levied a tax on the people. So in Israel, everybody goes, you know, with their groggers, ooh, on tax. You know, it's like Haman, you know, a lot of taxes, very high taxes in Israel. So taxes were, of course, a part of every culture. And in the ancient world, taxes meant you were either paying the king to build his armies, or you were paying the temples to support the building of the temples and, you know, lavish and outrageous numbers of sacrifices to all those gods. Now, what we have in the Torah is a new idea of taxation. Look on the very last page from Devarim, Perek Yud Daled. It says here, Mikzei shalosh shanim, totsi et kol ma'aser tvuatcha b'shana ahi v'hinachta b'sh'arecha. We know that there are different types of ma'asrot that the Torah tells us to give, some to the Levim, some to the Kohanim. In the third year and in the sixth year of the Shemitah cycle, then we're meant to take all of what would have been ma'aser given to other purposes in other years, and we're supposed to bring it to the entrance of the city. Chavtet uva ha-levi, ki ein lo chelik b'nachala imach, v'hager v'hayaton v'ha'amana asher b'sh'arecha, v'achlu v'saveyu. In this third year and in the sixth year, what happens is that we take the maaser and we put it at the entrance to the city gate, and all the have-nots, there's the haves and the have-nots, all the have-nots come and take, the Levi and the Ger Yatom ve'amana, and they are meant to eat there. Now, what's revolutionary about this? This is the first example in history of what we call today a redistributive tax. That is, much of our taxes today, well, they go to support, you know, government infrastructure, you know, we need to have police, we need to have an army, etc., we need to have garbage collection. But today, in most Western societies, there's taxation for the purpose also of supporting those that are less well off. This idea is first found in world history in the Torah as well. And you can see that what's going on here is not just supporting the poor, but where does it happen? It happens bish'arecha. It happens so that what has developed into a situation economically where you have producers, farmers who are well off, and then you have Levim, who don't have any nachala, and you have the other, the widows and the orphans, etc., who also don't have, which just naturally, in every culture, the haves like being with the have-nots are left out. Here, it's not only that we support them, but it becomes something that binds people together. It happens in the gate, and everyone eats of it together. The halachas of borrowing and interest are also revolutionary in their time, and I think have something to say as well today. Coming back to Vayikra Chaf Hei, we have here Perek Chaf Hei, Pasuk Lamed Zayin. It's on page 2 of the handout. Pasuk Lamed Zayin. Et kaspecha lo titen lo b'neshech, uvemarbit lo titen ochlecha. This is one of many psukim in the Torah that tells us that we can't charge interest. Very famous. Let me give a little backdrop to this. In the ancient world, everybody charged interest. Everybody charged interest. In fact, what turns out is that in most cultures, interest payments were 33%. That's heavy. That's really harsh. And you can see how when interest payments are 33%, very quickly the haves have a lot more and the have-nots have a lot less. Now, what's interesting, why does the Torah say that we can't charge any interest at all? Maybe it should have been a smaller measure of interest. Maybe it's say interest should be 2%, 3%, 5%. We know that the Torah allows us to charge interest to non-Jews. And again, I think what's happening here, it's not that there's anything immoral about charging interest. It's that it's part of this idea that I said before of primitive insurance, that if I have some money and I see that my neighbor doesn't, my neighbor again, who is my neighbor? My neighbor is my brother. My neighbor is my cousin. Right? Then I am duty bound to help him out, and then if the tables turn, the same thing happens. I've had a new insight about this idea of not charging interest at all from what's happened now in recent times, and really how this whole crisis began. I mean, it's an octopus and it has many tentacles to it, and how we've gotten to the state we are. But I think many of us understand that part of what got us into this big mess. Us, I should say the Americans. I'm American. What can I do? Has to do with the easy credit that was available for a very long time, that people could get very large loans at very low interest. And that seemed to be great for everybody, right? Because it meant that people that maybe would never before have had the opportunity to build a home could now get a lot of money and not have to pay so much for it. And the banks were happy too, because they were getting interest and they were getting all sorts of service fees, and everybody was happy with it. And now we see what's happened, that when you make money available, when there's easy credit at low interest, there's a lot of danger to that, because people don't always know their own limits, because people borrow more than they should, because the banks are getting the profit that they want and don't have a sense of communal responsibility either. I wonder whether charging zero interest in a certain way doesn't mean that people are able to borrow money more easily. It means that people have a more difficult time borrowing money. You see, the moment that we have just a little bit of interest, there becomes a financial incentive for some institutions to offer those loans. When you have no interest, then it means that loans are really only being given out because someone is really hurting and I have to help him out. There's no gain for me in it when I give a loan to my fellow cousin, because I'm not going to get anything for it. It's really only because I have a responsibility to help him. He's my cousin. He is mishpachti. And tomorrow I will be his mishpachto when I'm in trouble. I'm not necessarily saying that we have to have zero interest loans, but the principle idea here is that when people are in trouble, loans are a good thing if the interest isn't so high, but also if it's not so easy to get. And I suspect that when interest was zero, it was not so easy to get a loan. And we've seen now, as I said before, for ourselves, the danger that inheres when interest is low, people want to take a lot of loans, and there's another side that's getting a lot of benefit from it, and no one is really checking, is this going to be good in the long term? And here we are today. Let's have a look. Back at Pasuk Yud. Debt release, bailouts. How do we bail out? So Pasuk Yud, I just want to go back to that Pasuk. It says, V'kideshtem et shnat ha-chamishim, shana, ukratrim dror ba'aretz v'cho yoshveha. Dror means freedom. What's the freedom? Everyone returns to their land. The freedom that's happening here is the freedom from debt, right? What's happened? I had to sell off my land because I was in shtuch. I got sick, or there was a drought, or I got injured. I had to sell off my land. In the 50th year, I get my land back without having to pay for it. That means that even though I'm in debt to somebody, the debts effectively are wiped out. They're wiped out in the 50th year. And of course, as we all know, debts are also canceled in the Shemitah year as well. Now, what's really interesting is that this idea of bailouts, of just canceling debts in one form or another, happened throughout the ancient world. And it's very interesting to see what existed elsewhere and how the Torah has tweaked, has played with the idea in a new way. So I want to explain to you what would happen everywhere else in the ancient world. Where Avraham Avinu came from, this is how they did it. But it's everywhere. It's in ancient Greece, in ancient Egypt, everywhere. A new king would come to power. And when a new king would come to power, in his first year, he would proclaim debt relief. Let me explain why this would happen. Inevitably, because most of the money was located in the hands of the very few, when you would have famine or when you would have disease or drought, then the have-nots would immediately become at the mercy of all those that had. Think of the stories of Yosef, right? When Yosef nationalizes all the land, the people are totally starving. They're totally at the behest of the king. That's not so good for kings, because kings like to fight wars. And no one's going to go fight the king's wars if he's starving and if his kids are starving. And so it's in the king's interest to make sure that the masses have a basic amount of money. And so what would happen universally is that in the first year of a king's reign, the king would declare debt relief. Cancel the debts. This would do two things for the new king. A, it would make him really popular. I mean, just imagine, you know, if the prime minister here or the president of the United States said, okay, all the debts are canceled. That'd be great. I mean, he would really skyrocket and be terrible for the economy. But you'd have a lot of great masses of people would be very happy. So debt relief in the first year of a king's reign was a way of bolstering the new king, right? When things are unclear, is he going to be a strong leader? Does he have a strong base of support? By canceling debts, the king gets a very strong base of support from the masses. One second. I'll take. No, no, no. Debt between people. Ah, that's the second part of what I was going to say. Always, the people who owe money are far greater in number than the people who are receiving owed money. Okay, and the people who would be owed the money, okay, would typically be lords and nobles who were precisely the people who might be in a position to challenge the king. And so, by declaring debt relief, it on the one hand gives a great base of support for the king, and it weakens the strong rich people who are around him. It's a brilliant idea. Okay, now. It's interesting, this practice of debt relief in ancient Greece was called philanthropa. That's where that word comes from. Philanthropy is this. This is where the word comes from. And as I like to say, fundraisers have a difficult time because people like to give money to see their name on the wall or to see their name on a building. And what we see is that philanthropy in its origin was about erasing debts, you know, without any name on the wall or anything like that. But this is what went on all over the world. Now, in Akkadian, which is an ancient Semitic language, might be what Avram Avinu spoke, in addition to Hebrew, this was called andurarum, as in ukratrem dror l'chol yoshveha, just that word that we saw here. Look, you can look at it in Pasuk Yud. B'kideshtem eshtanta chamishim shana, ukratrem dror. Pardon me, I just have to roll that resh. It's kind of habitual. And it's the same as what it was called in Akkadian, andurarum. Okay? Now, what does the Torah do? The Torah also has debt relief. But look what happens. In the Torah, it has nothing to do with the king's reign. It has nothing to do with if there is a king or there isn't a king or what year of his reign we're in. In the Shemitah year, we cancel debts, and apparently in the Yovel year, we cancel debts. Put differently, debt relief to help people get back on economic footing is not a political tool for a king in power, as it was universally everywhere else. Rather, it's a legislated right for each and every member of Am Yisrael. This, I think, has a lot of application today. You know, they just passed in Washington this big stimulus package, and the president had said in his campaign that there's not going to be any more earmarks. Okay? And then sure enough, in the stimulus package, there are 8,300 and something earmarks. That is, local politicians saying, here, I want to build a bridge here, I want to build a theater there. And the great concern about this is, okay, we need to spend a lot of money to get the economy stimulated. But we want to make sure the money is being spent in the wisest way possible, that it's not becoming a tool to serve some special interest, whether it's a special interest in a bank or whether it's a special interest of somebody in government. And this is exactly what the Torah was aware of, that when you have debt relief, it can sometimes just be nothing more than a tool to help bolster someone in power, namely the king in his first year. What the Torah says is we're going to have debt relief without making it a tool for someone's power, because we're going to legislate that it happens automatically every seventh year and then in the Yovel year, in the 50th year as well. There's one final aspect of the Torah's economic policy. We're all so aware of it, but it's so revolutionary, and there's just such another dimension to it that I want to bring it out here. It has to do with how we measure time. How we measure time. See, in the ancient world, to measure time, well, they didn't have watches, they measured time primarily in three major units: days, months, and years. And that kind of makes sense if you think about it. Days, how do you know when there's been a day? Sun rises, and then some period of time later the sun rises again. Not like it's been the last few days when you can't see the sun at all, but the sun rises, okay, when the sun rises again, we'll call that a day. A month, what's a month? You look up, and you see what's happening, the waxing and the waning, and, you know, when it disappears and then comes back again like a little banana, we'll call that a month. 30 days, 29 days, it's a month. And a year, if you're really sharp and you kind of look at, you know, where the sun is falling on you in shul, you know, I know exactly when May 12th is. That's when I can't see anything anymore because the sun is right in my eyes in shul. So they could do that back then. They didn't have shuls, but they figured out the sun sort of comes back to the position it was a little while back. That we'll call a year. Month, day, or day, month, and year. Notice what's missing? In terms of how we measure time? Okay, hours. Okay, yeah, that's true. You kind of need to watch for that. Yeah, what else? Weeks. There were no weeks in the ancient world. Nobody had the notion of a week, of measuring time as 7 days. Okay? This is an invention of the Torah. The Torah is the first place in the ancient Near East where we find that there's going to be time measured by a week. And you can understand why there are no weeks anywhere else. How would you know what a week, what's a week? It's not a year doesn't divide by a week. A month doesn't divide by weeks. Weeks are artificial measures of time. They don't pertain or they don't refer to any astronomical happening in the skies. And of course, the week comes from Maaseh Bereishit. The Torah tells you why we keep a week. But now what's so fascinating is that every time the Torah talks about these sevens of time, whether it's weeks or whether it's the Chodesh HaShvi'i or whether it's the Shana HaShvi'it, always, 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 what these sevens talk about explicitly in Chumash is not just about Kedusha and not just about a Kodesh Baruch Hu, it talks about leveling out. Right? Lo taseh kol melacha ata uvincha uvitcha v'abdecha v'amatcha v'hemtecha v'gercha asher b'sharecha. Now, that's very, very interesting that the Torah wanted to hit home really hard that every so often we're all going to be leveled out. He who owns and he who is owned all stand on equal footing pretty regularly, weekly, and then in the seventh month we have all those chagim, and then the seventh year, all that. It's remarkable that the Torah, it would seem, made up a new way of measuring time devoted solely to that principle. And I think that that's a really important thing, because what that does is that it sends home a message about what's important in society. See, we live in a primarily capitalist society, and so earning money, getting ahead, producing, having economic advantage is a really big idea out there, and we get sucked into that. We get sucked into that. What is important? To succeed. What is important? To have more money. And what the Torah does by setting up this new way of measuring time, which was new at the time, obviously, is that at all these intervals of seven, we're sort of shaken out of that. There's no money being made today. Everybody is going to be equal. What are we really about? What type of community are we forming? What are the higher messages that we're all devoted to? And I think that this is a really, really important element to introduce precisely in an environment that's capitalistic, because capitalism run amok is very, very unhealthy for the soul and unhealthy for the community. Let me just sum up here. In the last few centuries, there have been basically two broad theories of how the economy should be set up. One was socialism. Socialism said, well, we need to really be concerned about people. Everyone needs to receive what they need, the greater good. And not necessarily that what I produce is for me. It will be redistributed. It's a very noble idea, but it hasn't worked anywhere, not on national levels and not on communal levels like kibbutzim. All the kibbutzim today are abandoning that idea. And apparently it's so noble that real humans can't live up to it, because when I have to work hard without seeing the rewards at the end of the day, inevitably this produces sloth and laziness. And if there's some central body that's sort of busy redistributing the money all the time, then that becomes corrupt. It's noble, halavai that we would all be tzaddikim and could live up to that, but apparently we're not. So that's one theory. The other theory is, okay, capitalism. Everyone will work hard and everyone will get what they want. And the problem with that in its purest form is that that leads to greed, and that becomes the be-all and end-all. It's very interesting. It's very hard to define the word greed in today's culture. What is greed? What, you work hard, you have a lot of money. Isn't that self-made man? Isn't that just hard work? Isn't that just the fruits of our labors? See how that word greed has really lost a lot of meaning in today's world. And all economies today are trying to find the balance between those two ends. No one's got it right. It's a constant tinkering to get it right. Almost every country does it a little bit differently. But what we can see is that the first attempt to balance these two systems was in the Torah, because in the ancient world, it was all the money should belong to the king and to the nobles. The Torah is not socialist. It's very clear. Everyone owns private property. You can get rich. It's mutter. Okay? But at the same time, there's a real awareness that together with that recognition that people want to work for their own living, that people are not capable of just working hard and then giving it all out, is the recognition that there has to be a balance of how we help others, and particularly what I started out with. It's not just doing a little bit of chesed here, giving some tzedakah to the needy. It's realizing that we function economically not as individuals, but as parts of communities. V'ish al mishpachto yashuvu. So that when times are rough, we're not owing alone, we're owing as part of a community. And we instinctively, just as when someone is sitting shiva, the chicken soup comes over, or when a woman gives birth, the meals are all taken care of. Or if somebody, Rahman al-Litzlan, has a real disaster, people just pull together. It's not chesed. It's not staka when I do that. It's a sense of existing economically with those around me. We are very, very fortunate. Shabbos forces us to build a community. Not just Torah mitzvot. Shabbos, particularly. We all have to live near each other, put up with each other, see each other on Shabbos. That has enormous economic benefits. It means that no matter what happens to any of us here, we're not really owing alone. We have what to fall back on. Most elements in American and Canadian society don't have that. We are really very fortunate. And I think that especially now, when many people are in a state of growing stress economically, now is the time to really reaffirm our commitments to our communities, to become even more involved. The more we become involved, then it might be that we have more contacts, but even more than that, we become bigger givers, we become more caring about others. These are just healthy midot. These are things that help us ourselves when the times are rough. And so that our involvement with the communities, v'ish al mishpachto, reaffirming our sense of commitment to communal organizations and institutions, giving up our time, it's good for others, no less so, good for ourselves. Thank you very much. Okay. Yes.
Robert Herman, you provided me with a lot of very valuable insights. One in particular was when you mentioned that the Torah invented the idea of private property.
Yeah.
And in doing so, it not only introduced something new, but it totally turned on its head the previous idea of the priests owning property.
Mm-hmm.
It then said, priests, everybody else can own property, but not the priests. Everybody but. In other words, it was a total reversal.
That's right.
I mean, that's what's so interesting about the Torah, that it's so revolutionarily profound in turning everything on its head.
Yeah, right. I should point out, often I'm asked when I discuss the thesis of my book that the Torah is trying to create a very equal society. And, of course, the first question that comes up for many people is, what about Kohanim? Well, when you look at the idea of priests in the Torah, relative to what was going on elsewhere, it's exactly as the gentleman said here. It's really turning things on their head. So yes, we have Kohanim who have a special purpose in the Mikdash, or a special purpose that they should dedicate themselves to learning Torah so that they can teach Torah, but it's a very far cry from what priests were in other cultures, where they were the big bankers. I mean, the temple was Goldman Sachs, you know? I mean, it's where all the money was. They had all the power. And so the Torah says precisely because we're going to give this type of elevated status, spiritually speaking, in the Mikdash, we're going to diminish their power economically and not allow them to hold land. Yep. Yes. Right. It's not clear how well it works in good times. And it's not clear that the Torah's prescriptions about about canceling debts, about returning land, how that works in a real economy. That is to say, as you pointed out, who's going to want to buy land and who's going to want to give money? And if you don't do that, then you don't have credit flowing and you don't have economic growth. That is a critique of the system. And it's not clear from the subsequent stories in Tanakh to what degree this system was ever really implemented. There are some indications in Yirmiyahu about this sort of thing, that in the Shnat Shemitah people would go free, a little bit in Nehemiah, it's not quite clear. That's why I wanted to focus my comments this morning on looking at these laws in the Torah as not so much a prescription for how an economy should function, certainly not today or even back then, but what are the underlying ideas here, and especially the idea of how we exist economically as part of a community, and the positive effects that come from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, this is great because it's good at this time.
Yeah.
I mean, the real job is to show that it's meaningful all time.
So that's why I tried to sort of abstract it into principles. So that's, for example, the idea of debt release, you know, that elsewhere was to serve the king. And today we have the same concern. Are we sloshing around tons of money in really the most effective way, or is someone gaining from it? That's trying to abstract principles that would be universal, because clearly so much has changed. We're not in an agrarian culture anymore, etc. Okay. No, yes, sir. For the masses. Right, so they had some land. Yeah. Well, what happened is that periodically kings would want to bestow favor on a trusted minister, a successful general, and so they would say, here, look, you've been a very loyal servant to me. Have a little tract of land. Here, it's for you. So there was some private property, but not for the masses like we have here. Okay, I think we have time for maybe one more question. Yes. That's much later.
I know.
Yeah.
I just wanted to point that and tie it to the completed the temple. It seems from the Greek Maccabees that the temple was used as a bank. Or
yes, this is the way it was in the ancient world, yeah.
But the temple was the temple used.
That's right. Well, a lot of things weren't the way they were supposed to be in the time of the Chashmonaim. That's just one example. Yeah. Anyway, these are the ideas that come out in the third chapter of my book about how the Torah's economic laws were radical and a very equalizing element, and how this ties in to ways in which the Torah views political office and theological notions of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. All of that is expounded elsewhere in the book as well. So thank you very much, and I wish everybody a Purim Sameach.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.